Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3085, United States of America versus Aaron Burroughs, appellant. Mr. Axum for the appellant, Ms. McCord for the appellee.
May it please the court, counsel.
Morning, Mr. Axum.
Tony Axum representing appellant Aaron Burroughs. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Burroughs' attorneys were deficient for failing to investigate his mental health, and under Rashad, because the government has not conclusively shown that Mr. Burroughs would not be able to demonstrate prejudice if given the chance, this court should remand this case for hearing in the district court.
Doesn't there have to be some indication that there is mental illness before they're obligated to do something about it?
I wouldn't say that there has to be an indication that there is a mental illness. Certainly that some indication that mental health is an issue. And under 3553, mental health is an issue in, can be an issue in every case. In this case.
Yeah, and we can't say they have to employ a psychiatrist in every case or ask for funds, can we?
No, absolutely not.
So what's the trigger that Judge Brown is looking for that we, because we don't write just for one case, we write for precedent, and what is the trigger that we could say exists here that requires the application for the mental health professional that would not exist in every case? As you just said, mental health could be an issue in any case.
It could be an issue in any case, and I'd submit that it's really a fact-specific inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
The individual nature and circumstances of the case and the history and characteristics of the defendant. And this case, the nature and circumstances involved a sex offense. And one
well,
of the
you couldn't say that they had required to have a mental health professional on every sex offense, could you? We couldn't require that, could we?
I'm not saying that either. It would still have to be fact-specific. But
How do you get around the policy statement of the guidelines that you don't grant downward departures for mental health issues and sex offenses like this? 5K2.13, diminished capacity policy statement.
I appreciate the guidelines policy statement, but even when the guidelines were mandatory, it was a policy statement. I would say that it has less force in the wake of Booker, Rita, and Gall. And for that reason, because the guidelines are not mandatory, and 3553 does not place a limitation on what the court can or should consider, an effective attorney, a reasonable professional judgment, once factors are identified to that attorney.
That's what we're looking for.
Grant and I are looking at those factors. What are the factors that were identified?
The factors in this case were, I'll start at the beginning. Mr. Burroughs' life to this point had been exemplary. There were no
that
other.
That makes it sound as. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
If we say that, you know, you can't win. You'd have to have a mental health expert in every case, because if you've had an exemplary life, then it's an aberration, right? I mean, it would always be true.
So at least every first offense, you'd have to have a mental health professional.
Well, from an attorney's perspective, the question that an attorney is trying to answer and is trying to present to the court when they go to sentencing is, why did this offense occur? And where there is no explanation, it would be logical, it would be prudent to investigate the mental health when it is aberrational, yes. I'm not saying that it would be required in every case, but once that issue presents itself, the attorney has to either decide that it's not in the client's interest or won't be fruitful to pursue that, or to decide that it would be. And there's no indication that that analysis was done in this case. But it's not simply one factor that is going to trigger a requirement for an attorney to investigate mental health. You had several factors in this case. You had that Mr. Burroughs had been depressed at the jail, had been taking medication for that depression.
Now, being in the jail, you got to catch 22 on that one. If you're in the jail and you're not depressed, you might be crazy.
Well,
just being depressed in jail is not going to get you there, is it?
I agree, and that's why I say it's not one individual factor. His in a letter to the court, his mother recommended some type of evaluation, probably growing out of the depression and that this was so aberrational for him. But that certainly should have prompted the attorney to investigate, to take some further step. But I'm talking all around what's really glaring in this case, and it's that the attorney obviously recognized the duty to investigate. He obviously recognized it because at the pretrial hearing, he says, I want to enter him into this psychological sex treatment program. He obviously recognized it because he asked Mr. Burroughs to pay for an expert to evaluate him. When Mr. Burroughs said that he could not afford to pay for that or wouldn't pay for it, the attorney didn't take any further step. That was an abdication of his responsibility to investigate the mental health that could have been proven crucial at sentencing in this case.
Can I go back, and again, I'm going to ask you about this statutory question. Maybe you can help me. As I read 3553B, it limits the discretion of the district court to grant downward departures for certain sex offenses, right? And 3553B2 says that you only get a departure authorized when a policy statement allows it, when a sentencing guidelines or policy statement allows it. And then you go to 5K2.13 and says, in this type of sex offense, you don't allow a downward departure for mental capacity. So am I missing something, or you dismissed my earlier comment as saying, well, you know, the sentencing guidelines are not mandatory anymore. But here in the statute itself, it says no downward departure for sex offenses unless it's consistent with the policy statement. The policy statement itself says none in this case. So isn't there in addition to the problem that my colleagues have identified, that there being no indication that there's a mental health problem here, don't you have a more fundamental problem, and that is the statute bars what you're asking for here?
The first thing that I would say to that is that there is a difference between a variance and a downward departure. And although the statute may bar a departure, the court could nevertheless vary, and competent lawyer would recognize that a court could nevertheless vary, and for that reason, despite what the statute says about departures.
So you're saying this isn't a departure? He wasn't seeking a downward departure?
He didn't seek either. He didn't investigate mental health. So
Saying he should have sought a variance rather than a downward departure?
If the statute barred a downward departure, he was not also barred from seeking a variance.
Other than semantic, what is the difference here, counsel? Why is this not a downward departure?
Frequently there is no difference, but Gall set up a system for deciding what the guideline sentence would be and didn't totally displace the guidelines and the process for determining what the guideline sentence would be. And departures fall within that regime, within the guidelines regime. So under the process that the court should follow after Booker, Rita, and Gall, it would have to calculate the guidelines, decide what type of departure it wished to grant or the defendant qualified for, or reject any departure that the defendant didn't qualify for, and thereafter factor that number, that sentence, in with the 3553 factors, and could deny the departure and grant the variance. In this case, because the attorney did not investigate Mr. Burroughs' mental health, he never reached that second point of whether to pursue a departure or a variance. And just with regard to whether Mr. Burroughs' exemplary background should have prompted the attorney to do something, Wiggins v. Smith said directly that, particularly in light of a defendant's of a lack of aggravating circumstances in a defendant's background, an attorney should look into the reasons for the offense. Separate from the reasons for the offense are the attorney should have looked into the mental health of Mr. Burroughs to determine what treatment he needed.
Yes,
what the
a little more than looked into. You're saying that he committed failure to provide adequate representation by not moving for court appointment of a psychiatrist or court funding of a psychiatrist or mental health professional, right? We actually have to find that the failure to do that was inadequate representation in order for you to prevail.
I'm not sure that was the only option available to him.
That's what you argue for in your brief, isn't it?
It is correct that that option was available to him. Yes, he should have. If he didn't have the services of a mental health expert otherwise, he should have petitioned the court for funds to hire an expert. Yes.
We kept you past your time, but we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal if you need it.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mary McCord on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, absent a categorical rule that defense counsel in a sex offense case is constitutionally deficient if he or she fails to request a psychological or mental health evaluation of his client for purposes of sentencing, absent that kind of a rule, there is no basis in this record for this court to remand for a hearing on appellant's claim. Like the record in this case well supports the defense strategy at sentencing, which was to present the defendant as a law-abiding citizen raised in a stable and loving family environment, volunteering in the community, who had an aberrational misstep, one bad judgment that caused him to get into this trouble. That strategy was supported by everything in the record. It was supported by his educational and work history, his lack of criminal record, his volunteerism in the community, his immediate cooperation with the government when he was arrested, his work with other inmates in the jail to help them get their GEDs, his successful completion.
Could I ask you about some of the conditions of,
yes,
of his release? What in the world does his offense have to do with computer use? Why these draconian restrictions on his release?
No. Well, I would hardly call these draconian restrictions. In fact,
supervising
not
his use of the computer?
Well,
monitoring his use of his use of computer. What's that have to do with his? Was a computer involved in his
computer
offense at all?
Computer is not involved in this crime. But there is nothing in Section 3583 or any other part of the sentencing
guidelines, what's the connection between use of computer and his crime?
Well, it's conditions of release that are reasonably related to the nature and circumstances of the offense.
What are they? What are they? He didn't use a computer in his crime.
That's correct. But what he did is he put himself in places of access to teenagers. He worked as a volunteer high school football coach, which is in fact where he met the victim.
So because you can meet teenagers on the computer, therefore restrict, that's a reasonable restriction?
I think it is a reasonable restriction, but particularly in a case like
are there any limits on that? I mean, why is it not the case that in virtually any crime you can, if you're clever enough, you can use the computer to aid and abet your crime somehow?
In effect, in Stanfield, it was an identity theft crime. It was not committed using a computer, and a computer restriction was imposed. Now, Stanfield is misrepresented a little bit in appellant's reply brief because it's not a case where this court or the government conceded that computer restrictions were not reasonable. It's a case where the original computer restriction was an outright ban, and the government agreed that that was overbroad. The restriction was revised on remand and was narrowed. And on appeal of those narrower restrictions, this court held that they were still ambiguous, and it remanded again for further clarification. It never said they are unreasonable, nor did the government concede that they would be unreasonable in a case that didn't involve computers. And that's because...
Identity theft is a little closer to computers than child molesting and prostitution.
Well, it could be, but not necessarily, because as I've cited in the government's brief, there are numerous cases in the federal reporters where defendants have used computers to solicit child victims of sexual abuse.
I'm afraid we've seen numerous ones.
Is there any evidence that this defendant had done that?
There is none in the record. However, Your Honor, when he is released, he will not be allowed the normal access to teenagers that he has enjoyed in the past. And if he would like to get back involved with teenagers again,
I'm not questioning the restrictions on his contact with minors.
I want to talk about that one just a minute.
No. I'm just talking about his restrictions.
No, I understand, but I'm saying
no use of computers. In this case, no. Now, did he have access to a computer?
It's not no use of computers.
Did he have access to a computer during the time the solicitation and abuse of a minor was taking place?
Yes, but
is there any evidence that he used the computer
not in the record? But he didn't need to.
What do you mean not in the record? What are you trying to suggest?
Well, I'm not going to go outside. I happen to prosecute
don't even mention
this
it.
Case.
What's the point of mentioning it? You're obviously suggesting that
No, I'm not trying to suggest that. Computers were seized. We brought no charges based on the computers.
Right. Okay.
I'm not trying to suggest anything, so I apologize.
Therefore, our assumption has to be there was no evidence on those computers.
That's a fair assumption.
That's a constitutional requirement.
My point is it was not about the contact with minors restrictions. My point is that he enjoyed full access to minors prior to his arrest in this case. He regularly was at the high school. He regularly was in contact with minors. When he is unable to do that due to his supervised release conditions after he is released, if he should want to get back in contact, the internet is the logical way for him to do that. And without monitoring...
The telephone is as well.
It is.
So is there restriction on his use of a telephone?
There is no restriction, and if there was, I would probably argue that it's reasonable, because this is the type of crime that is committed by reaching out to minor victims, and that's what he did here through his volunteer work with the high school and with the Boys and Girls Clubs, and that's what he could easily do via the internet. And again, I would emphasize, he is not actually even contesting computer restrictions. He's not contesting the monitoring of his computer use. What he's contesting is the burden of having to keep a daily log. And I'd submit that potentially...
He was contesting the software that would...
And having to pay for the software.
And I see, with notifying the employer, is he contesting that also?
I think he is, although that's just sort of a discretionary. It's agreement that you may have to notify employers about these supervised release conditions.
As I understand, the only thing he's not contesting is the notion that someone can come in and look at what he's done with his computer at any time, right?
And even the monitoring of it.
Random, unannounced searches, right?
And I also don't think he's contesting the monitoring of it. He just doesn't want to have to pay for the software himself, as I understand the briefs. Now, Mr. X can clarify that if I'm wrong about that. So I think this notion that it's not reasonably related to computer use is already pretty much conceded by the defendant's own position and on appeal in this case. Judge Chantel, you wanted to talk about the...
Yeah, at first reading, that no contact condition is draconian. No contact, direct or indirect, with any child 18 or under, as the defendant suggests in his brief, he couldn't go to McDonald's. When's the last time you had somebody take your money at McDonald's that wouldn't possibly fit?
Well, I think we've explained incidental contact.
The government is agreeable to a reading of that on our part, and I would say possibly a published reading that says that cannot be construed to include accidental or incidental contact.
That's correct. And
otherwise, as the appellant suggests, You can't go to the grocery store.
No, I understand. And there's abundant case law out of the other circuits that have said as much, and we agree with that. Now, I would point out as well that this court just a month ago in the United States versus Love case, which I provided a 28J letter about, upheld on plain air review, which is the review we are on here, both for the computer restrictions and for the contact with minors restrictions, upheld on plain air review the identical language of this restriction. Mr. Exum points out,
if there were no precedent, would you be trying to defend the literal application of that language?
You mean like even in incidental contact?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that's ever been the intent. The intent is not to go loiter around boys and girls clubs, not to go.
Now, there was a separate loitering sentence in there in addition to the loitering sentence. There's not the one I'm asking you about.
It's right. And I do think there are issues of going to functions, birthday parties and the like, and that is prohibited by this condition. And if at some point, 14 years down the road when he's released, on supervised release, and if there's a reason to try to seek a modification of that from Judge Leon, he can do that. But it's not unreasonable, and it certainly
passes plain air review. Or by that time, some successor to Judge Leon, possibly.
Let me ask you about something slightly different, which is the standard to be applied here, because I think appellant makes a kind of interesting argument, which is that it's not plain error, but a reasonableness standard.
Under Bras,
even though he did raise no objection at the time those conditions were imposed.
Well, first of all, the easy answer to that is this court has certainly post-Bras applied plain error review to the failure to object to supervised release conditions at sentencing. But the more interesting, I think, substantive response I have to that is that in Bras, there is some sense to the notion that when you are talking about the substantive reasonableness of a length of incarceration, there's not a reason for the appellant to make objection, or the defense counsel or defendant to make objection to that at sentencing. Because what's happened is the parties have allocuted for the appropriate length of sentence. They've had full allocution. The court has now announced its sentence. It's a little silly for defense counsel to then stand up and say, I object to that. And that's what Bras was about. In this case, with supervised release conditions, it's different. There was no, particularly in this case, there was no discussion prior to the court announcing the supervised release conditions about those conditions. There was the discussion about length of incarceration. There was the discussion about, the mitigating factors, I guess, that the defense wanted the court to consider in imposing sentence. And after the court then imposed sentence and announced his conditions, he turned to the parties and said, are there any questions?
And why would the length of sentence be any different than the conditions of release under Bras?
Well, I think it has
to
do with.
Bras is talking about length of sentence as way of distinguishing. I want to read you something from Bras.
Mm-hmm.
That aspects of a sentence that go to severity, such as conditions of release involving deprivation of liberty greater than reasonably necessary to achieve the goal of statutory goals of sentencing, should be reviewed for substantive reasonableness under Booker, regardless of whether an objection was raised below.
Well, that was not what was at issue in Bras, and it hasn't been applied
I'm
that
sorry.
Way.
I'm sorry. That's not from Bras. That's an appellate brief.
I was going to say, I don't think
I'm
Bras
sorry.
Said that, but not
I'm
having
sorry.
It right here on the podium, I didn't
sorry.
Want to
I
quarrel with the court.
Yes, that's a quote from a brief that was filed in Bras rather than from the opinion. My apology.
That's all right. But I do think the significant difference is there was opportunity to object. It was provided, and there was no objection, unlike when counsel have fully explored and made arguments for length of sentence and the court announces sentence. So I think this is very different from Bras, and in fact, this court has consistently applied plain error review.
Well, I should have made carefuler notes when
That's all right, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, we'd ask that the court affirm the judgment.
Seeing none,
thank you, Your Honor.
We will thank you, counsel. We will give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Axel.
I'd like to address the mental health issue briefly. I'd also note for the court that mental health treatment is a standard condition of supervised release in sex offenses. So that being a standard mandatory condition of supervised release places sex offenses certainly in a different category. I'm still not saying that in every sex offense the court has to require or oversee an evaluation, but an attorney, knowing that it's a standard condition, needs to be in a position to advise the court, needs to be in a position to object to aspects of that treatment when the court imposes that condition that do not go to his individual client. And the attorneys in this case were not in that position because they didn't investigate mental health.
If we were to rule with you, would the court have to inquire into what the actual capability of the defendant to pay for his own mental health professional was at that time? As again, as I understand it, you're saying they should have applied to the court for court funding of a mental health professional. They were retained counsel, not appointed, so apparently the defendant had some assets at that time. I realize you're appointed, he has none now, but the status of the quo of the status at that point, is there anything in the record that shows us what his financial capability was there?
I don't know that there's anything that shows what it was at the time, but he told his attorneys that he didn't have the funds to pay for it. He had been incarcerated for 2 years, and I think it's a fair assumption that being incarcerated and not working means that you don't have income, even if your family has paid for the attorney or you had money initially. But I see that my time is running out, and I'd really like to address some.
Take another minute.
The computer restriction. The court is correct that Mr. Burroughs did not use a computer in this crime.
Why didn't he object to the unannounced random searches of his computer?
To the extent that his attorneys didn't object, they were ineffective. I don't have an explanation. Okay. But I would say, as I argued in my brief, that Bross, to envision the situation that would have preserved this error, is precisely the situation that Bross talks about.
But what I'm getting at is, why didn't you raise it on appeal on plain error? That issue is, as far as I understand, you have not appealed that part of the supervised release. Am I wrong on that?
The computer restrictions?
The unannounced random searches of the computer.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes. That is correct.
That seems, at least, I don't want to argue the case for you, that seems to be inconsistent with the other objections to the computer use.
It's not inconsistent because the probation office is charged with supervising people, and whether the condition was imposed with regard to computers specifically or not, probationers have a lower expectation of privacy under the Fourth Amendment, and the probation office could come and search regardless of whether that condition existed. So it wasn't.
Is that right?
It wasn't so much that
they could search his physical premises, and the question here just eliminates any argument about a difference. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. So it was. While we still find that offensive, we understand that the probation office can already do that. So the condition didn't add anything, was not more restrictive than necessary. It's already allowed. The other conditions are not already allowed and were more restrictive than necessary. Under Bross's standard, what would have occurred when the district court announced sentence is for him to have preserved these errors and for this court to have plenary review would be for his attorney to stand up and say, I object to the conditions of supervised release. That is the type of objection. No defendant wants more restrictive conditions of supervised release than necessary. So the objection that would have been raised in this case would exist in every case. And that's all that we're saying for why this court should review those conditions,
under reasonableness.
Right, yes. Okay. Thank you.
Unless there are further questions, we've gone over time. So thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. Call the next case.